Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context, chat with experts, and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in! So, Emma, you are phoning in from a fun new location today.
Yeah, I'm sitting in my mom's closet. I hope that the audio is okay. Because my mom moved into a new house. She moved across the country, all the way up to the Danish border. And it's quite lovely here, but she hasn't furnished the house yet. So it's very echoey everywhere. So I just went into the smallest space that has the most stuff. And I hope it works.
Yeah, small spaces that have a lot of stuff. That sure sounds like my closet. Like, way too much stuff, like, cramming it in there.
But I feel like if you don't have an overflowing wardrobe, then what are you doing? If there's still space, what are you doing?
Well, that's coming from the two of us, which, like...
Yes.
But really, I feel like a closet, truly, you have to have, like, a Halloween costume from 5 years ago in the back, and, like...
Yes.
A really, really heavy winter parka that you wear maybe 3 days of the year. And then, you know, a nice shirt that you say, oh yeah, I'll definitely wear this next year. Every time you clean out your closet. And yes. You never do, but it stays there because it's the shirt.
Yes.
So you're heading on vacation after this, or is this part of your stop?
I know in American dimensions, we didn't drive that far, but we drove pretty much across the entire country. So we drove like 6-7 hours. Germany's small. But this is kind of like the first part of our vacation. And then tomorrow we're driving a little over 2 hours to like our actual vacation spot. It's gonna be great. We're going to this vacation park thing that I used to go with my dad. We went every single year because my dad's a magician and he used to work there.
Favorite piece of Emma lore, dad is a magician.
Yes. He actually published, I don't know if I've told you this yet, my dad published a book. Did I tell
no,
you
No, what?
I knew you would love it. I need to send you a picture. Because it is hot pink. It's the funkiest looking book.
Is it
it's
about
so cool.
Like doing magic?
Well, my dad, I mean, he's a magician, but he also has a degree in social work. And so he kind of like developed this way of doing magic because he does a lot of courses generally and workshops. He kind of like put both of those things together where he decided to make this book and launch these courses about how to teach a child magic in like a learning kind of way. And it is especially meant for example for kids who are estranged from their parents, that they can learn something together, have that experience of learning something together, that both the child and the parent kind of like have the same knowledge, and it's like equally hard or easy for both of them.
The premise of this book is so wonderful.
It's very sweet. I cried a little. I'm so proud of him because he always wanted to write a book. And like a year ago, he was like, I'm going to do it now. I'm just going to get my ass up and do this.
Congrats to your dad.
I'll tell him.
Talking about things that you do with your parents in your formative years, mine was watching reality television with my mother.
That's cool too.
We were so tuned into the pop culture of the time, and now I'm really grateful for that, because you ask me anything about the 2000s, I can just rattle it off for you, because I was there, I was watching those trashy shows at like 12 or 13 years old, I remember. One of my formative pop culture memories, along with Britney shaving her head, Bieber fever, Lady Gaga's meat dress, Zac Efron in Hairspray, and Kanye stealing the mic from Taylor Swift was the massive success of the movie Dreamgirls. This was the movie adaptation of the Broadway musical, and it starred big names like Jamie Foxx, Eddie Murphy, and the Beyoncé. Do you remember when Beyoncé was an actress? Because yes. I remember when Beyoncé was an actress.
Briefly, but I do.
Its breakout star was American Idol alum Jennifer Hudson. You can place the exact moment in the movie that won Jennifer the Oscar, her emotional rendition of "And I Am Telling You I'm Not Going," as her character, Effie White, is cruelly fired from The Dreams, the group she founded.
And I am telling you I'm not going. You're the best man I'll ever know. There's no way I can ever go. No, no, there's no way. No, 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 no way. I'm living without you. I'm not living without you.
The Dreams are largely based on the Supremes, and Effie based on their fiery founder, Florence Ballard. Flo sang on 16 of the Supremes' top 40 hits and 9 of their number ones, but she did not have the happy ending Effie gets in Dreamgirls. Flo passed away at just 32 years old, penniless after trying and failing to sue for royalties Motown duly owed her. Many authors call her the Lost Supreme, as she was virtually erased from their history after her firing in 1967. But as this episode will show you, Flo Ballard was anything but just a backup singer. She was brave in the face of her hardship and a true trailblazer, the very spirit of Motown's first girl group.
Florence Glenda Ballard was born on June 30th, 1943, in Detroit, Michigan. Her father, Jesse, came from Alabama as part of the Great Migration, a wave of black families moving north to find work at the auto factories. Jesse worked at General Motors for over 30 years. He met Flo's mother, literally, when she was just 14 years old. Florence was the 8th of their 13 children, 8 boys and 5 girls. She never found having this many siblings abnormal, as lots of other families in her neighborhood were just as big as hers. Though Jesse made money at GM, he struggled to keep his family fed and housed. Lurley felt guilty that she couldn't buy the children toys or new clothes. The Ballards had to move many times between low-income housing projects, but Flo looked back fondly on her younger years. Quote, "My childhood was very bright. Of course we were poor, but it was a happy time for our family. They didn't need toys. They played pretend or with the neighborhood kids. Little Flo was always a daddy's girl. When she couldn't sleep at night, she'd crawl into his bed. When he got home exhausted from the factory, he'd pick up his guitar and play blues songs." All the Ballard children were encouraged to play instruments, but Flo loved to sing most. She'd sing everywhere, with her siblings, at church, at home, and for the relatives that visited. She'd even open the windows and sing Christmas carols into the night. It was Reverend Williams, the Ballard's pastor, who took the step to nurture 5-year-old Flo's talent. He offered her and her sisters candy or a trip to the ice cream parlor as incentive to join his church choir. Lurley saw it as a way to keep her kids off the streets and out of trouble, but for Flo, it was her life. Once Jesse saved up the money to buy his family a record player, there was 24/7 music in the Ballard home. Always the ringleader, Flo got her sisters to stand around the record player and sing. She'd parade them all around the neighborhood to sing with her, as if they were a girl group. Flo found a true singing partner when she met Mary Wilson at Bishop Elementary School. Flo admired her personality and the stylish dresses her family could afford, since there were only 2 children to clothe. Quote, "Mary was always sharp, boy. Mary was always sharp. They performed together in their school talent show, and from then on were best friends." A wave of black celebrities influenced pop culture in the 1950s. Chuck Berry and Little Richard forged ahead in rock and roll music, and groups like the Coasters and Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers popularized doo-wop. Though America loved music made by black musicians, the music industry was still segregated. See Pat Boone recording Tutti Frutti or Elvis co-opting Chuck Berry's moves. Though Flo and her family struggled, Detroit's auto industry thrived. That money poured into the community. In fact, Detroit was named America's most beautiful city by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Thanks to the city's public school system, correctly deducing that funding art programs produces a better, more well-rounded education, there was a lot of young musical talent. These kids could easily afford musical instruments, thanks to department stores having the option to lay away. But since the music industry was still segregated, Ray Charles was pretty exclusive to R&B and soul charts, there was no record label to exalt talented young black people. Not yet.
Meanwhile, Flo Ballard grew into a kind and beautiful young lady. She had reddish hair and such light skin that her friends nicknamed her Blondie. Her voice was just as gorgeous. Quote, "She was like the Etta James or Aretha Franklin kind of singer because she had so much soul," Mary fondly remarked. One day, as Flo and her older sister Maxine sat on the porch, a shiny red and white Cadillac pulled up to the curb. The driver was Milton Jenkins, a local concert promoter. He was managing a new group called the Primes. While looking for a talented group of young ladies to be their primettes, he heard Flo at her last talent show. She nailed her primettes audition, of course. Milton asked her if she had any friends who liked to sing, and she immediately volunteered her best friend Mary. Then came Barbara Martin and Betty Travis. When Betty's schoolwork kept her from the group, another girl from the neighborhood joined, Diane Ross. She, of course, changed her name to Diana Ross, so to avoid confusion, we'll be calling her Diana for the rest of this episode. With the addition of Betty McGlown, the group auditioned once again to be the Primettes. Flo chose the Ray Charles song, "Nighttime is the Right Time," for them to sing. She sang lead, Mary and Betty sang backup, and Diana took the high parts the Raylettes have on the record. They instantly knew they had it. Early on, the girls decided they wouldn't just have one lead singer. Instead, they'd go by whose voice was best to sing any given song. Flo sang the soul songs, while Diana could sing the teeny bopper stuff. The Primettes performed at talent shows and saw cops alongside the Primes, but no clubs. They were only 14 and 15. Patrons loved them so much, they literally threw their money at them. "And don't think we didn't pick it up," Flo quipped. But in the midst of this exciting time for Flo, tragedy struck. Her beloved father, Jesse, passed away at just 54. Experiencing a death in the family while so young deeply affected her. For the rest of her life, she hated funerals, because they all reminded her of seeing her father's casket. Meanwhile, lightweight boxer turned army draftee turned music store owner Berry Gordy Jr. formed his fledgling Motown Records label. His goal was to bring black music to the masses, meaning both black and white audiences. His strategies became the music industry standard: etiquette classes, choreography, and media training for his artists, and lots of subsidiaries to ease DJs' minds in wake of the payola scandal. Motown wasn't just Motown. It was Tamla, Gordy, Hitsville, Mo West, Miracle, VIP, and Rare Earth come the 1970s. The Primettes first auditioned for Motown in their very infancy, the year 1960. The label's first female star, Mary Wells, hadn't had a hit yet, and were still several months out from Smokey Robinson and the Miracles making it big with their Shop Around. Gordy saw something in the Primettes, but they were just too young. "Finish high school first," he said. So the Primettes went back to the sock hop circuit to keep refining their talents. They switched managers and cut their Tears of Sorrow single on Lupine Records.
Yeah.
They were determined to be the best and to be on the very best label. They would get their chance in 1961. But in between auditions, Flo's life was harshly and very abruptly changed. One night, she went to a show at the Greystone Ballroom with her brother Billy. Through the excitement of the night, the two were separated. While Flo looked for her brother outside, a male friend of hers pulled up in his car and offered her a ride home. She accepted, feeling she had no reason not to trust him. But instead of taking Flo home, he drove her to an empty parking lot and he raped her at knife point. Though her family urged her to go to the police, Flo refused to tell anyone her attacker's name. "It's his word against mine," she thought. And besides, she didn't want to ruin the life of a promising young man.
What about him ruining the life of a promising young woman?
There you go.
For months afterwards, Flo retreated completely. She rarely left her family or her home, missing so much school she had to drop out of the 11th grade. Meanwhile, the rest of the Primettes had no clue why Flo wouldn't return their calls. They couldn't perform without their leader. It took a long time to feel as though she could face them again, but Flo invited Mary and Diana over to explain what happened to her. Mary was shocked. Quote, "You could see that she was no longer the girl she was. She was like the void of whoever she was, and that was so terrible," she emotionally recounted on a 2019 Sirius XM appearance. The girls supported Flo as best as they could, though none of them could fathom what had happened. Though music helped Flo rise above in the moment, her family and friends said she was never the same. Her cousin Raymond said, quote, "She kind of never got over it, and I think, as she got older, it actually kind of got worse." Flo started hanging out with Mary, Diana, and Betty again to keep her mind off of things. Every day after school, they did their makeup and put on their best clothes to literally stake out in front of Motown Records. They would wait for the male groups to arrive and they'd flirt with them, hoping they'd be invited inside Hitsville, USA. This sounds a lot like the Ronettes getting dressed up to hang out in front of the Peppermint Lounge.
Yes.
I love girls who are so determined. If you can't believe it, one day this stakeout plan actually worked. A group that was supposed to provide hand claps for a record didn't show, and Berry Gordy himself invited the Primettes inside. But the girls still had to prove themselves. They were young and didn't have the Motown polish. Berry would hire them as a backing group, on the condition they changed their name. They no longer held name recognition as the female Primes, as the Primes were now the Temptations. There are a few different versions of how the new name came to be. Some say a secretary gave the girls a list, others say Flo came up with the Supremes herself. Whichever it was, Flo pushed for the Supremes. Diana wasn't thrilled. She thought the "ets" suffix was more feminine, but majority and Berry Gordy rules. And on January 15th, 1961, the Supremes were signed to Motown Records. They were the first girl group on the label. Shortly after signing their contract, Betty had to drop out of the Supremes. She was newly married with a child on the way, and in the early 1960s, a woman absolutely could not be visibly pregnant and performing. They tried to find a suitable replacement, to no avail. The Supremes would remain a trio for the rest of their career. After school, they'd go right to Hitsville. Some days, they'd sing backup on records. Other days, they'd do secretary work. Still, Flo waited for the Supremes to get their shot. Their first single, Tears of Sorrow, didn't go anywhere. But the flip side of their second, with Florence singing lead, was a local hit. Buttered Popcorn got airplay in 1962, and Flo was anxious to hear it. Quote, "All that day, I was turning on the radio, turning to different stations, trying to pick it up. It was just a fantastic feeling to hear myself singing." Berry decided not to release Buttered Popcorn as an A-side, though. He wanted the Supremes to have just one lead singer. The same year as Buttered Popcorn's local success, the Supremes were invited on the annual Motortown Review with 40 other performers. Mary Wells, The Temptations, The Contours, and Little Stevie Wonder all shared the bill, which the Supremes were way at the bottom of. If they were listed at all, sometimes they were just called "and others."
Imagine going to a show of, like, all of the Motown groups, and the Supremes are at the bottom of the bill.
Yes.
I cannot imagine that nowadays.
No. But this was before they hit it big, and it just shows you how Motown Records had such an array of incredible artists.
Mm-hmm.
The review was trial by fire for Motown's artists. If you were really stars in the making, you'd thrive. If you didn't have what it takes, you'd get dropped. Though the show made a point of playing for integrated audiences, the review had its fair share of frightening racist incidents. In Macon, Georgia, someone opened fire on their bus. When they woke up in Florida, they found the facade riddled with bullet holes. On another occasion, the Miracles were chased out of a gas station by a man with a shotgun. They didn't serve black people in the front, Flo said of eating at restaurants on tour. You don't come in, they give you your food to take with you. You better carry it out or you get shot.
The Supremes were tailor-made for success. All three had the singing chops. Mary was the soft-spoken one, Diana had confidence in spades and a radiant smile, and Flo could command a room with her hearty belt. But everyone else at Motown seemed to make it big before them. The girl group signed after them, the Marvelettes, had Please Mr. Postman. Then the Contours had Do You Love Me, the Miracles recorded You Really Got a Hold on Me, Mary Wells had You Beat Me to the Punch, and Marvin Gaye began his superstar ascent with crooners Let Your Conscience Be Your Guide and Pride and Joy. Nearly 3 years after their signing, the office mocked Flo's group, calling them the no-hit Supremes. It wasn't for lack of trying. They were produced first by Berry Gordy himself, then Smokey Robinson. It took several flops and a stellar gig with the Temptations to gain access to Motown's premier writers, Holland, Dozier, and Holland, HRH for short. In October of 1963, the same month Martha and the Vandellas broke through with Heatwave, the Supremes got their first top 40 hit, When the Love Light Starts Shining Through His Eyes. Diana sang lead on the song, not Flo. The Marvelettes rejected what was to be the Supremes' next single. The Supremes themselves weren't crazy about it either. We didn't want to record that at all, Mary said. They said, trust us, it'll be a hit. We said, yes, but it sounds like a kid's song. It's not like Martha and the Vandellas dancing in the street. It's Baby Baby. Very childish, right? I was the main one saying we'll do it, but my God. Hey, it's something, and the Supremes were itching for a hit. The week of August 22nd, 1964, while the Supremes were on Dick Clark's Caravan of Stars, they finally had it. Where Did Our Love Go hit number one. The song was simple, different, and had good timing, Flo put it, and it was good for Diana's breathy voice. When the caravan concluded, Barry flew the girls back to Detroit instead of putting them on a bus, a show of his congratulations. Then in October, while they toured England, their next number one and perhaps their greatest hit came, Baby Love. Hit after hit rolled in for the Supremes through the end of 1964 into 65. They celebrated with their first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show. Suddenly, the no-hit Supremes were huge. Interviews, TV appearances, magazine features, Coca-Cola ads. There was even a Supremes-branded bread.
Come on, Supremes, let's sing that song!
I'm having a real good time, dancing the night away.
NASA broadcasted Where Did Our Love Go to space. If Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell were the prince and princess of Motown, the Temptations and the Supremes were the kings and queens. Marvin looked up to Flo and her spunk, remembering her as, quote, a beautiful person, loving and warm. She was down to earth, she loved to laugh, and everyone loved her. Among the Supremes' famous fans included Princess Margaret and the only group the Supremes consistently competed with on the charts, the Beatles. They recorded Motown tunes like Money, That's What I Want, and You Really Got a Hold on Me. But their meeting with the Supremes was rather embarrassing. Flo found the Fab Four terribly immature. Clearance racks no more, the Supremes shopped on Fifth Avenue and had as many as 12 costume changes a night, all custom made. They became the most successful and most glamorous group at Motown, known for their perfectly done hair and makeup, glittering gowns, elbow-length gloves, and graceful choreography. They were the picture of sophistication. This is what the early girl groups were about. We're a long ways from the Ronettes, Beehives, and the Shangri-La's leather jackets. Unbeknownst to Flo, the glamour came at a cost to her and the Supremes. Their expenses came out of their own pay. Quote, Motown never paid for anything. We paid for it.
Now, too famous for the revue, the Supremes were booked in prestigious clubs with mostly white audiences. The Coconut Grove, the Safari Room, the Twin Coaches, and the legendary Copacabana. They were the first pop group to ever play Lincoln Center's Philharmonic Hall. Each of the Supremes made $250,000 a year, but Flo alleged she never saw her share. She admitted, I didn't have a business mind. I didn't know that we should have seen the contracts. I should have known how much we were making for each engagement. The money should have been placed in our hands. Flo sang on a parade of iconic Supremes hits. Baby Love, Come See About Me, Stop in the Name of Love, Back in My Arms Again, and You Keep Me Hanging On. As the equally famous cover by Vanilla Fudge proves, the latter was a soulful song made for Flo to sing. But Diana got the lead. Diana was getting a lot of special treatment, actually. Relationships between acts on the label were fairly common, if hidden from the public. Flo briefly dated Temptation Otis Williams. What wasn't normal was the boss, Berry Gordy, having a relationship with one of his acts. Berry had fallen in love with Diana Ross, and in 1964, he left his second wife to be with her. He was willing to do anything to make Diana a star, even if it meant giving her special treatment. He got her extra etiquette lessons and paid special attention to her. But he came down on her twice as hard, too. It was a toxic dynamic, which we'll be sure to explore in an episode about Diana. Mary was deeply unhappy with how her childhood best friends were being pitted against each other, but she didn't voice it nearly as much as Flo. A vintage size 12, modern size 6 at most, Flo was cruelly nicknamed the Fat One in the Supreme scripted onstage banter. This clear bluff made it easier for a Dreamgirls audience to understand by casting a plus-size actress to play Effie. In response, Flo developed a sharp sense of humor. She could throw a one-liner with the best of them, and the audiences loved it. When she was called the Fat Supreme, she'd retort in a low voice, "Well, I think I eat more than she," referring to Diana. On other occasions, she quipped, "Honey, fat is where it's at." And at a show at the Coconut Grove, Diana called Flo the Quiet One. She quickly remarked, "That's what you think." The audience cracked up. Quiet, Supreme, she was not. Flo was confident, assertive, and had plenty of spunk. Her rich voice was highlighted on the few songs that she sang. Hey Baby, Heavenly Father, and her rendition of Sam Cooke's Ain't That Good News.
Oh, my baby's coming home tomorrow. Ain't that good news? Yeah, ain't that news? My baby's coming home.
Motown had complete control over the Supremes' image, from their music to their personas and even their public relationships, never mind the fact that gossip columns were whispering about Barry and Diana. Romances had the potential to be controversial. Flo was black and her boyfriend at the time, Roger Pearson, was white. "I never knew if the stairs were for her or for the both of us," he said, but the couple was largely left alone for the time they dated. As funk brother Earl Van Dyke put it, quote, "Barry never let anyone bother the musicians." Author Nelson George added an important caveat. They weren't bothered as long as they remained musicians and not artists. This, of course, didn't apply to Diana. By 1966, her and Gordy were seriously considering her potential as a solo artist. They started billing the Supremes as Diana Ross and the Supremes, thinking that if they were billed as both a feature act and a group, Gordy could demand twice the money to book them. Flo did not take kindly to being relegated to a backup singer. This was the group she founded. She was the original Primette and an original Supreme. Time and time again, she lost songs to blatant favoritism or punishment for talking too much. She was supposed to sing House of the Rising Sun, but that went to Diana. Manhattan was cut from the Supremes' Sing, Rogers and Hart album. Her final straw was when she lost her final remaining number in the show, Barbara Streisand's People. Partway through a residency at the Copacabana, Motown employee Harvey Fuqua appeared at rehearsal to announce that People was now Diana's song. Quote, "We all suspected that Barry had taken the song from Flo, but Flo was thoroughly convinced of it, and she was crushed," Mary said. Helpless onlookers of the situation described Flo as looking like she was stabbed in the heart. She rushed off stage crying. How much more of the spotlight did Diana need, Mary wondered in her book. From that moment on, Flo regarded what was in fact the highest achievement of our career a disaster. She was sad and moody, and I could see the three of us being torn apart. Flo would never again have a solo as a Supreme.
People. People who need people.
There were contract troubles, too. All the money Motown spent on the Supremes was subtracted from their share of royalties, which were just 0.75% of 90% of the shared retail price. So, if a Supreme single sold 1 million copies, which 8 of them did, the girls would make only $5,000 each minus costs. These expenses included their hair, makeup, and costumes on tour. Quote, "Our personal dresses would cost maybe $100, $200. Then we bought the perfume that cost so much an ounce. One year, I spent $4,000 on clothes." "That's not much, especially if you're a millionaire," Flo said sarcastically.
But that is also so much more in 1960s money.
Yes, a dress that was $100 or $200 in 1965 would be in the thousands today.
Yes.
The Supremes' deal was renegotiated once they were no longer no hits, but it wasn't much better. They'd get 8% of 90%, but now this came from the wholesale price instead of the retail price like before. This 8% was divided between all three Supremes, leaving each with just 2.4% of a share. Quote, "In 10 days, we grossed over $100,000. Boy, I sure wish I could have gotten my hands on it," Flo remarked. Furthermore, Motown held the rights to the Supremes' name. This will become very important in Flo's story. if for some reason one of the girls couldn't record a song, she wouldn't receive any of the royalties upon release. The girls worked at breakneck speed. Quote, "I didn't realize how many albums we recorded until lately," Flo said in 1975. "We were always recording, recording, recording. Then I heard some tune on the radio not too long ago and I said, God, phew, I forgot all about that one." By 1967, the Supremes were in a precarious position. The Motown sound was losing ground to the flowery folk and rock of the Summer of Love. Diana distanced herself from the group, getting more involved with Gordy and going solo. Mary could overlook how the whole show was now structured around Diana. She just wanted to be a Supreme. What she couldn't ignore was how everyone treated Flo. From all angles, Flo heard she was getting fat and that her relationship with Gordy's driver, Tommy Chapman, was a distraction to her. Scandal broke when the public discovered Flo had dropped out of high school, though no one but her fellow Supremes knew why. Flo missed gigs. She got sick, then was overworked on the set of a TV appearance and got sick again. When she turned up to a headlining gig with the Buffalo Springfield and the Fifth Dimension to find Cindy Birdsong in her costume doing her choreography, she was rightly incensed. Cindy was no average replacement. Motown had been working with her for months behind the scenes. Quote, "It was as if they were saying, we're getting ready to put you out now. I was thinking, I may be out, I may be in, that sort of thing. But I was trying to keep calm about it and not worry about it. But I was wondering, am I in or am I out?" It was cruel, and the paranoia ate away at her. In response, Flo drank more. Her family feels that her drinking was a trauma response. She never addressed what happened to her in her teen years. She never went to therapy, let alone spoke about it with family or trusted friends. Flo's cousin Raymond, sister Maxine, and Mary Wilson have all stated that Flo used alcohol as a coping mechanism. Mary naively assumed that once the Supremes were rich and famous, Flo would be happy again. But she wasn't. People just didn't openly speak about sexual assault like we do now. It also didn't help that alcoholism in women was, and still is, taboo. When we think of an alcoholic, we usually think of a working-class man sat on the bar stool, not the wine mom, or a successful performer like Florence Ballard. In her own biography of her younger sister, The True Story of Florence Ballard, Maxine notes that their father, Jesse, also drank a lot, hinting that Flo was genetically predisposed to alcoholism.
Flo's last night as a Supreme was at the Flamingo in Las Vegas. She recalled, quote, "I had me a few drinks and they kept calling me fat so much until I went on stage and I poked my stomach out as far as I could. It was a step too far. Gordy finally had the excuse he needed to replace her." In July of 1967, 2 weeks into the Flamingo residency, Florence Ballard was fired from the group she founded. Cindy Birdsong was quickly put into the show. Diana and Mary were giving a story to rehearse and to repeat to the media. Flo was tired from touring and wanted to be with her family. Motown offered Flo a contract extension at first. To do what? Sit around the office and do nothing? Instead, she took the measly $15,000 settlement to be paid out over 4 years. She signed away all the rights to her royalties and relinquished the right to use the Supreme's name in any future projects. Humiliated, she left the office in tears. Though Diana Ross sings lead on virtually all of the Supremes' greatest hits, those hits dropped off after Flo was fired. From 1967 to their disbanding in 1977, the Supremes only had two more number one hits. From 1963 to 1967, they had had nine. After leaving the group, Flo wore her natural hair in defiance of the processed styles and wigs Motown insisted upon. On February 29th, 1968, Leap Day, she married her boyfriend Tommy. People close to her did not approve of her new husband and manager. Their housekeeper described seeing her with bruises and black eyes. Though Flo never spoke of it, she knew they came from Tommy.
After much dragging their feet, Motown wrote Florence several checks for her $75,000 share of the Supremes' bank account, plus $20,000 for her work in the group, $5,000 for her gigs as Diana Ross and the Supremes, a $135,000 payment from Motown Records, and $140,000 more in assets. All these checks were supposed to be handled by Flo's lawyer, Leonard Baum. Baum means tree in German, that's why this is messing with me right now. Flo was now able to pursue the next chapter of her career, becoming a solo artist. She signed with ABC Records in 1968. Despite the label not having much experience promoting black artists, they're best known for the Mamas and the Papas, and Motown not allowing her to use Motown or Supremes to promote herself, Flo was hopeful. Her debut solo single, It Doesn't Matter How You Say It, flopped, and so did the follow-up, Love Ain't Love. The gigs she got were a far cry from the days of the Copacabana. Tommy wasn't much of a manager. Flo said, quote, "All of a sudden, it seemed I was blackballed. My records weren't played and there were no bookings. The album she was recording, You Don't Have To, was shelved. And in 1970, Florence was formally dropped by ABC. When she returned to Detroit from ABC Records, Flo was in for the shock of her life. Baum told her she was broke. All $375,000 from Motown was gone. It took years to find someone, anyone, who would help her. But it seemed Baum was miraculously friends with every lawyer in Detroit. This made for a string of conflicts of interest. Flo and Tommy went all the way down the list. The Wayne County's prosecutor's office, the Michigan Attorney General, several congressmen, the American Bar Association, the IRS, even the FBI. No one could help Flo track down her money. It wasn't until February of 1971 that she found a law firm willing to help her. On her behalf, they filed an $8.7 million lawsuit against Motown Records, the Supremes, and Berry Gordy. Flo wouldn't be the only Supreme to bring litigation on her former label. 7 years later, Mary Wilson sued for the rights to the Supremes' name. Flo's suit alleged the label withheld the money from her former lawyer, Baum. As far as Flo, Tommy and her new lawyers knew this was the case, but in a cruel twist of fate, the judge found that the release Flo signed upon leaving Motown stated she couldn't sue unless she paid them back $160,000. $160,000 of the very same money she was suing them for. Besides, Flo would never have the upper hand. Quote, "Baum came back and told me, well, look, if I take it to court, Berry Gordy's going to say that you drink." Flo couldn't bear the shame of being outed to the world as an alcoholic. The suit was dropped.
Eventually, Flo's new legal team uncovered the ugly truth. Baum had cashed all the checks himself and spent all the money Motown gave her and the $15,000 advance from ABC Records. He'd also taken $147,000 from the estates of four of his other clients.
What?
What?
This makes me so mad.
This man was stealing close to $1 million.
In 1971. That is so much money. And the fact that he was friends with everyone and that's why she couldn't go to anyone else is so messed up. Because what comes to my mind immediately is that he gave people money, her money, that she was trying to get back just for them not to take her on as a client. I'm just going to say that's kind of what I'm thinking happened. Because there's no way he was just friends with everyone in the city. Because then he couldn't even work as a lawyer because he would never get a single client because he couldn't go up against anyone.
It's so slimy. He was eventually disbarred, but the damage was done. Florence was bankrupted by years of legal fees. Then Tommy left her and their three children. It seems that once the money was gone, so was he. Flo filed for divorce in 1972. Tommy avoided paying child support so much that Flo had no choice but to apply for aid to dependent children. She was humiliated. Quote, I'd always been independent, ever since the age of 15. I'd always worked at babysitting and stuff like that, and then I got involved in singing. I was always doing something to make money for myself. Being on ADC after making all that money was a hard blow, Flo said. Peter Benjaminson observed, Florence Ballard's talent propelled her from a world of poverty and insignificance into one of luxury and fame. Then she was cruelly tossed back. The stress drove her to drink more. She'd wander around drunk without knowing where she was. Quote, it was like I was in a daze, just walking. It was like I didn't care anymore. I had given up. This got her in very dangerous situations. She was mugged twice. She lost the home Gordy insisted was paid for. When Diana heard of her ex-bandmate's troubles, she wrote Flo a check for the mortgage. But Flo was so paranoid she didn't cash it, and the house was foreclosed on. Mary remembers Flo dressing up in what was left of her Supremes outfits and driving around for hours, parking in front of her old house and staring wistfully inside. Then Flo had to sell that car to make ends meet. Maxine offered to house her sister and nieces, but Flo moved them out again so the kids could stay in their school. In November of 1974, the stress became too much, and she checked herself into the psychiatric ward of the Henry Ford Hospital twice. On her second visit in 1975, she confessed to the doctor, I'm an alcoholic. I can't understand why I keep drinking and why I keep feeling so bad all the time. Instead of explaining to Flo that she was self-medicating, addiction is a disease, alcohol is a depressant, or that, when abused, alcohol leads to misguided actions that cause further depression, like acting out on stage, this doctor told Flo she wasn't an alcoholic. Because how could a woman possibly be an alcoholic? Despite this egregious error, Flo did attend Alcoholics Anonymous meetings for a time, but she lacked proper support from medical professionals, therapists, and loved ones, and she stopped going.
In early 1975, Detroit Free Press writer Peter Benjaminson was approached by his editor for a story. Florence Ballard was on welfare. He couldn't believe it. A former Supreme on welfare seemed impossible. He drove right to her house to interview her. When Flo and her daughters got back from the grocery store and invited Peter inside, he noted how well-dressed they all were. It was clear Flo made sure her girls were well cared for, despite their dire circumstances. Though she was too embarrassed to accept the help of the Good Samaritans calling her house, Flo was pleasantly surprised by the overall reception to Peter's article. It even got her one last singing gig at a Joan Little benefit concert with backing group The Deadly Nightshades. Peter had officially earned Flo's trust, and it got her singing again. She had Peter conduct several more interviews in the final year of her life, from which he wrote the biography, The Lost Supreme. Quote, she was always dressed casually, but neatly, Peter remembered in the foreword, with clear skin and a ready laugh. On each occasion, she served me glass after glass of Kool-Aid and talked in a low, pleasant, but somewhat depressed drawl about the ups and downs of her life. After years of legal runarounds, Flo finally received a $50,000 settlement from Leonard Baum. She used it to buy a car and a house. She even invited Tommy to move back in with her and the kids. Her life was back on track, but it wouldn't last for long. Years of heavy drinking had deteriorated her health, and on February 22nd of 1976, Florence Ballard passed away. A blood clot made it to her heart. She was 32 years old, her youngest child just 4. Lurley couldn't bear to attend Flo's funeral. This was her 5th child she'd lost in her lifetime, along with her husband Jesse. She couldn't bear to bury another. Instead, Mary Wilson attended, as did Diana Ross.
The Supremes reunion on the Motown 25 Yesterday, Today, and Forever TV special was something of an embarrassment. Not once was Florence's name said, and fans were not pleased. But in late 1981, Flo's story would be immortalized, if stretched for dramatic effect, when Dreamgirls premiered on Broadway. Jennifer Holliday won a Tony for her role as Effie, the tragic Florence character who ultimately got a happy ending. Berry Gordy Jr. was transformed into the cunning, manipulative womanizer businessman Curtis Taylor Jr. Barry never had a relationship with Florence like Curtis does with Effie. Diana was Dina, Curtis's puppet who overlooks his poor treatment of Effie until it threatens her own career. This characterization of Diana Ross still affects her public image today. In 1988, Flo was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with the Supremes. Flo's daughter Lisa gave the speech on her mother's behalf.
I would like to say that I'm very pleased to be here tonight representing my mother. I don't have too much to say, but I would like to thank all of the directors of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for inducting my mother. Thank you.
After ABC Records' catalog was acquired by Spectrum Music and later UMG, Flo's shelved solo album, You Don't Have To, was released as the Supreme Florence Ballard in 2001. David Geffen sold the movie rights to the Dreamgirls musical back in the 80s. Many attempts to adapt the story, including the likes of Whitney Houston and Kelly Price, failed. Dreamgirls was finally made into a blockbuster movie in 2006. Jennifer Hudson won a Golden Globe and an Oscar for her portrayal of Effie. Her performance was true to Flo's spirit, bold and passionate, anything but a backup singer. Jennifer dedicated her Golden Globe win to the real woman her character was based on. Of the original Supreme, Florence Ballard, she poignantly said, "She will never be forgotten." Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the life of original Supreme, Florence Ballard.
As always, we're Emma.
And Abby.
Your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review the show on your favorite streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until the next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.